We're going to get started, the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Thursday, February 25th. We do not yet have a quorum, but we are going to get started. Representative Olin, you're first on the agenda, and we can't really make a motion yet, so if you want to speak to your bill and let us know what it is and what it does, then we'll let you make a motion as soon as we get a quorum. Representative Olin.
Basically, my bill is House File 38, and it corrects something, a little glitch in the statute presently existing that the Supreme Court found and gave us a recommended fix. Basically, what it does is right now you can charge prisoners to stay in jail. This is local jails. But there was an exception, and what was happening that the court ruled against us on was that persons were getting something like a 90-day sentence. They had already sat in county jail 60 days before that, and they're getting credit for time served, and that 60 days was never subject to the pay to stay. And this is just a glitch to make it consistent so all the time that they get in county jail on any sentence is actually subject to pay to stay. If it's a situation, they can make the payments. And I have with me Rick Hodson of the Minnesota, on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and John Tuma on behalf of Intercounty Association. I'll call on Rick Hodson.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'll go first. My name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Thank you, Representative Olin, for carrying this bill, Madam Chair. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Tuesday, all of us lawyers are walking around remembering those horrors that we had to suffer for 2 days doing the bars. So our thoughts are with you. So
thank you.
Good luck. This bill came to our attention from a court action in December. It was a bill that was passed in 2002. And apparently there was a big buffoon of a chair who wasn't paying very close attention on the House floor and accepted the Senate language.
Was that you?
I think it was, Madam Chair. I went back and looked at the history, and I was like, oops. I saw him trying to fix the problem that we created by not clarifying the law so that the courts overturned a situation that Mr. Hodgson will explain in a second. But there's history that we do this. This is, again, we gave a maximum flexibility to counties to decide to do this. I don't know if I probably can't see the full map here because of the zoom, but not every county in the state does this. This is something that the counties have the ability to choose to do or not do. They have to balance between the interests of those who are convicted and are in jail versus the interests of the property taxpayers. And it's something that some of our counties felt back in 2002 was fair to say, if you're going to stay in our little resort, you might want to pay a little bit for that stay. And so, Madam Chair, this is something the counties do use, but not everybody does, and they're balancing that. And we just want to fix a minor glitch that the court kind of gave it to us, which in turn turns out to be a mandate then upon local counties. And I'll let Mr. Hodgson explain that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Richard Hodgson, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. As was already indicated, I am legal counsel for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I have been doing that so long that I actually have seniority over the 87 sheriffs. I've been their attorney longer than any of them and been sitting in office, so that's my survivor claim to fame here. But I tell you that so you have a flavor of a background of where I come from and trying to resolve this matter. As was indicated, in 2002, the Minnesota legislature, in an effort to reduce impact on property taxpayers, which are the ones that fit the bill for jails, gave local counties, through their sheriffs, an option to impose what's known as commonly known as pay for stay. It simply means if you are an individual who are arrested, charged, and you're going to end up in local jail, and you're ultimately convicted, the local government even has the option of requiring you to pay for those expenses. The legislature gave local governments the option, the discretion. You can see from the map that a lot of counties did, far over half. Some of them chose not to. Some said, we'll use that, let the offender's money be used for other purposes, child support, restitution, whatever. So they made that policy change. And at the time, I trained almost 80 counties in what their options were. The question is, who can be required to pay? The argument we used, the analysis we used, which was valid until December 3rd, 2009, was anyone who's convicted under Minnesota law, we've worked really hard in Minnesota for fairness between people who are able to make bail and those who are not. And to do that, we've developed what is known as a credit for time served policy. If you get convicted of any crime, any time you spend in custody serves against your sentence. Basic fairness, basic equity. And an extension of basic equity was, based on the legislative language, it was our belief that as long as you were convicted of a crime, whether you did that 50 days or 60 days, as the representative points out, before you got convicted and then walked out the door when you pled guilty, or pled guilty and then did your time, you should be in the same boat, and therefore the jails that it used paid to stay did not make a distinction. Well, and we were great until December 3rd, 2009, at which point the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, the way we interpret the language, because the legislature used the word offender rather than person, you can't impose pay for stay until after the person has been actually convicted. That, as you just heard, was not the legislative intent as far as we knew. That's not how any of the counties acted. And it's our position, it's fundamentally unfair. It's also creating delay and the potential for problems now. If I'm a defense attorney and I know my client is going to do 60, 90 days in jail, it would almost be malpractice for me to say, look, you're going to get convicted. Don't make bail. Do your time on the front end, because I've just saved you X amount of dollars per day in a county that has pay for stay. We're trying to reduce that incentive to delay cases and stretch these things out. And I suspect a few of you have heard about the financial issues that might exist at the judicial level. Why do we do anything to exacerbate it at the county level as well? So what we bring to you today is a bill for property tax relief that doesn't cost a dime of state money, and that certainly should be attractive. What it does, you know, the Supreme Court giveth and taketh away. This time they took it away, but they also give it. They told us in their opinion of Jones versus Borkart exactly the language that would be needed to fix the situation, to allow pay to stay to apply to pre- and post-plea conviction people. And that's the language you see before you in House File 3038. It's hopefully a simple fix, but it does have Jim Franklin, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and I have been trying to collect data over these last several days, besides finding the counties that use pay for stay, what kind of fiscal impact are we talking about? We're talking, as best we can tell from the surveys we've gotten back, about $1 million a year impact on local government.
We do officially have a quorum, so I will formally call the meeting to order. And Representative Olin moves that House File 3038 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Questions from members? Seeing none. Representative Cornish.
Would you mind if I asked a question? It was related to this, but not completely related to the bill.
Well, go ahead and ask it, and if you're too far afield, we'll stop you. Representative Cornish.
Sir, when you collect the money from the offenders for Huber or whatever you'd call it, network release, you used to be able to collect it for other things. It's still a sheriff's option to collect for restitution to pay right back to the victim, because what problem we're having in Blue Earth County is the sheriff isn't collecting the restitution, and the all they have is a threat of turning it over to collections. He's on 20 years probation for $1,500. He can run it clear out. Is there any method where the sheriff, if the sheriff still have the option like the old days, collecting money for restitution when he comes in with this check?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Hodson.
Representative Cornish, yes, there are mechanisms, there are multiple mechanisms actually now for restitution, for example. Besides working for the Sheriff's Association part-time, in my full-time life, I work in the Washington County Attorney's Office. One of the things we do is restitution type collection, and there are a variety of options. Revenue recapture, against income tax returns. We collected $5,000 at a welfare fund restitution at one point because somebody won a lottery scratch-off, so I want to encourage people that have those, no, I shouldn't say that. But there are a variety of those types of options. The sheriff, in terms of one of the reasons that some of the sheriffs have chosen not to impose pay for stay with our county boards is because their belief that first, let's take care of the restitution obligation first. There's a limited pot of money. We as sheriffs and county officials recognize that. So we'll let that money go to restitution and other obligations rather than try and take it off as child support. That's the beauty of this bill. It gives local governments that option. It empowers the elected decision makers, the 5 or 7 county commissioners working in conjunction with their elected sheriff to do or not to do pay for stay.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 3038 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Olin.
Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, 3018.
So the
tape is clear. Wasn't it?
Oh, 3018
is the other one that's written right in front of me.
Yeah, 3038, Mr. Representative
Coles.
I
was trying to be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Is Representative Paymer in the room? Okay, well, he's not here either. So I guess, Representative Bingham, you want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now we're doing 3018.
Yep. Oh, he's here. Is the second one?
Probably the 2991.
This is a bill that shouldn't affect us.
Madam Chair, to your bill.
Thank you. I would move that House File 2291. I'm going to ask that you lay it over for possible inclusion. So that'll be my motion after the presentation of the bill, Madam Chair.
Okay. Testifier, I'd like to begin the testimony on your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer. I work for the State Board of Public Defense. The bill that you have in front of you is sort of falls in the category of updating the law to recognize advances in technology. The law was written when we were exchanging documents. Now we're exchanging electronic files on CD-ROM, mostly DVD-ROM. And what this bill does is updates the statute to reflect that change. Frequently what happens is, and I'm sure you've had this happen just kind of in your own private life, somebody will give you a file and you don't have the program necessary to play that file. And so what this bill does is it says, provide us with the discovery material and provide us with the ability to look at it. It really doesn't do much more than that.
Any questions from the members? I will refrain from asking any on this one. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hellstrom, what is the, you talked about laying this over for possible inclusion. Does it go on to the Finance Committee then to be heard there? What I'm wondering, and I know that this is not the committee to be talking about costs, but I'm just wondering if they're going to have a chance to look at that from a financial standpoint.
Chair Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. I don't believe this has a cost. However, if there is a fiscal note that comes with it, then we'll just send it to the Finance Committee after. Otherwise, if it comes up back with a zero fiscal note, we then can put it in the policy bill. It's my understanding the Public Defender's Office does not believe that this will have a cost to the state.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. I agree with the policy behind this bill. And my question is really, I guess, around cost as well. And I recognize there's not going to be a cost to the state. But the concern I raised yesterday when I was approached about this bill, and I still have the concern. Again, I want to see how there's a way we can figure out how to do this, and we should figure out how to do this. I mean, the defense has a right to the information, and they've got to be able to view the information and be able to use it. But I'm concerned about software licensing and costs associated with software licensing, and I'm concerned about us requiring already financially strapped county prosecutors' offices to either pay for additional licenses or violate license agreements, which I don't think we want them doing. And so I only raise that as a concern. I think it's something that as this moves forward, we need to make sure that we are not in a position of putting the county prosecutor in a spot we don't want them to. And I don't know if Mr. Sikora has any comments along those lines. I know that the opportunity I had yesterday to speak about the bill, there was the indication that there's a willingness to work on that issue if there's a need to. So I appreciate that, but I did want to raise the issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I do have a response. And we are willing to work out whatever language so that we don't put somebody in that position. We don't want anybody to violate copyright. In fact, what happens most often is there is a process where you can convert a file to an easily viewed format. And so it is an extra step on their end, but then it allows them to convert it to a type of file that's viewable with a publicly shared, perfectly legal viewer, or in case of video, player.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, Mr. Sikora, an extra step is something that doesn't concern me too much. Extra cost is something that does start to concern me. So I appreciate that, and I think it's a good bill. We'll just have to the devil's in the details, and I think we can figure the details out.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, members, I'd just like to urge support. This happens to be a special problem in my district, where the chief public defender talked to me, and I think it's being done right in a lot of counties, or in some counties anyway, have no problem doing this, but there are some counties that need the urging and get into the 21st century and send something that you can read. And if it's not going to be a cost to the prosecutor, it might be a cost to the public defenders, or we also fund, but I don't think it's any cost to the state, and it shouldn't have to go through the Finance Committee, but that's just my opinion. So I'd urge support when it does come up again.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Is there anybody else who would like to testify on the bill? Mr. Kingery, if you come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery. Speak on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And I did indicate to Representative Hillstrom that I would make some brief comments this morning or this afternoon on this bill. We have not taken a position on the bill, but I want to share with you some of the concerns, some of the observations that I have heard with regard to this particular issue. You know, I think we all know that change isn't really easy, you know, and there's always a lot of starts and stops with any change. However, our offices have realized that there are savings down the road by moving to new technologies. I think you've heard about e-filing, e-charging, e-discovery, in which we are trying to get the flow of information in our criminal justice system to move electronically. We believe by making investments in those technologies that we will achieve savings in the long haul. And therefore, we, to the extent we have funds available, our offices are attempting to move in that direction. And we believe that's consistent with the guidance that have been given to us by the courts with regard to our justice system. We've all got to work together. I think you've maybe heard me say in the past that I look at our justice system as a three-legged stool, with the prosecutors, the public defenders, and the courts being the underpinnings to hold up our justice system, that we all need to work together to meet our responsibilities to serve the people in Minnesota both efficiently and effectively. And for that reason, we convened a task force back in 2003 to address a number of these technologies concerns when they were brought to us by the public defenders. And we developed what we call a list of best practices, and we feel that has served us quite well over the last 7 years. However, when the State Office of Public Defense brought to us recently additional concerns, we convened a meeting earlier this month, and we are looking at updating and revising our best practices that we would share with those in the field. And I believe that we've made progress in our one meeting, and we have plans to meet again. At our meeting, we identified a number of long and short-term goals. Our long-term goal, one long-term goal, is to consider a statewide server to handle county attorney and public defender flow of information, file information on a statewide server. That might be a possibility. We've had some informal discussions about maybe trying to find one of those numerous grants that seem to exist out there to possibly purchase such a server down the road at some point. In the short term, we are looking at revising our best practices model, possibly using the e-discovery process that is used in civil cases, and we're investigating that now. To encourage a common format for law enforcement when they are purchasing digital squad videos. If you've got six different half a dozen police forces out there and they're all purchasing different digital squad cameras, it makes it very difficult and expensive for both our offices and ultimately the rest of the criminal justice system. And so potentially there's thousands of formats here. We believe if we can work with our law enforcement partners, we can get them to minimize the number of the variety of purchases that they make in this area. We also discussed developing what I'll call, I shouldn't have a lawyer saying this, but cheat sheets to allow and trainings for public defenders and county attorneys in which we would identify the most common file sharing problems and develop workarounds to resolve those problems. In addition, JPEGs and PDFs would be provided on CDs and DVDs. WAV files, please don't ask me to define WAV files, should contain software information to open files if they are unique. And also consider a pilot project. Olmsted County is poised to move ahead in this area, and we are looking at a kind of an informal agreement to have a pilot project so we can work out those problems, those issues, as this goes around the state. Under Rule 9 of the Courts of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, it does allow for the electronic discovery only if the method is available to both parties. To do otherwise would violate the duty that we have as county attorneys. We do have concerns about potential licensing costs. Our offices don't have a lot of extra licenses. In fact, we don't have any extra licenses laying around, especially with the reductions to aid to local units of government. So would we have to purchase additional licenses, whether it be annual fees? It seems unusual to ask a local unit of government to subsidize a state office if we have to incur additional costs. I think an extra step, as it was alluded to earlier, that's not a problem. We're talking about licensure, potential licensure costs, which we are investigating at this point. I have no doubt that the State Office of Public Defense have heard some concerns from the field, as it has been expressed earlier. I've also heard reports from the field that this has gone very well. In some cases, local offices, county attorney, public defender's offices are pleased and delighted to move forward in this new area. And with that, that will conclude my remarks this afternoon, and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Kingery, just as somebody who deals with this on a daily basis, the other annoyances, the different codecs and stuff for surveillance video from businesses, is the variety that they have are very annoying as well. Representative Anderson, then Coles, then Cornish. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, where is this bill in the Senate? What's the status of the bill?
Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. It has been introduced. I don't know any further status of it, but we are going to lay it over for possible inclusion in the bill, and we can have all sorts of discussions about whether or not it needs to be fixed and how well the two groups have talked to each other between now and deadlines.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Coles.
Just a comment I probably shouldn't even make, Madam Chair, but I wish we could just all get along. We shouldn't need a statute to fix this. That's the comment, Madam Chair. I mean, you know, I understand if the public defenders are frustrated because there are a couple of county attorney's offices that are maybe being difficult, or maybe there are public defender's offices that are being excessively demanding and not being sufficiently cooperative themselves. You know, we get all these little bills and we take up committee time, and here I'm taking up more committee time. I recognize that. But, you know, can't we all just get along?
I'll remind you of that later on in the session, Representative Coles. Anything else, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Coles, I might add that I believe we fund the Public Defense Board, and if they don't have adequate software and licensures to do their job, I think that says something about the job we're doing as well. So in the event we are not giving everyone the tools they need to do their job, part of it is our problem, which is why I agreed to carry the bill today. So I think that's enough.
Mr. Kingery, did you have a final comment before we lay the bill over?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to make an extremely brief comment. We have been working with the public defenders and the courts with a series of meetings, both here at the legislature and around the state, to support adequate funding for our system of justice. And I agree completely with Representative Hillstrom that if we're going to have a justice system, it does need to be funded adequately, and it needs to operate efficiently.
Thank you. Any follow-up comments, Representative Hillstrom?
No, if there isn't anyone else in the audience, I would renew my motion that House File 2991 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy bill.
Okay, seeing no other comments on the bill, the chair lays the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should I just move my next bill, Madam Chair? No?
Madam Chair, I believe we have to adopt the division reports.
Okay. My understanding that Representative Lesh will be presenting Representative Paymar's bill. Is that correct, Representative Lesh?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Great. So Representative Lesh moves that House File 3018 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By way of brief explanation, because Mary Ellison is here with me, who can explain it much more thoroughly, current law for in cases of prostitution only allows us to track how many people were arrested for prostitution. Now, if you are a buyer or a seller, you get tracked in the same division, the same subdivision of statute. We're changing that so that you get charged in separate subdivisions, whereby we can accurately track who's buying and who's selling. Now, this is really important. There are a group of individuals in law enforcement with whom I've worked that are very dedicated to this line of work. Some of you may remember Officer Gerald Vick, who was shot in on the east side of St. Paul several years ago while engaged in these investigations. People like Officer Vick and there are other individuals in the Twin Cities are really dedicated to ensure how we address this as a societal problem, as a community problem, and which in often cases is a drug problem too. But in order to do that, we need the subdivisions separated. So with that, I'll hand over the mic to Mary Ellison, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mary Ellison, staff attorney with the Advocates for Human Rights. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. Madam Chair and members, these changes in House File 3018 help us to clarify the language of who engages in prostitution, clarifying that both patrons and prostitutes engage in prostitution. These amendments also, as Representative Lesh said, will allow us to better track data. There are requirements under both our state law and under the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act to track the prostitutes, the patrons, and also the traffickers and pimps. And these changes will help us do that. What we're doing is taking the current subdivision 2 of Minnesota Statute 609.324, and we're separating it into two subdivisions, which become Subdivision 2 and Subdivision 6 in your new bill in House File 3018. And then we're taking Subdivision 3 in the existing statute, 609.324, and separating it into Subdivision 3 and Subdivision 7. So it gives us the opportunity to track patrons and prostitutes under both our general prostitution crime and also under the prostitution crime related to prostitution in a public place. So they don't change the penalties. They don't change the content of the law at all. They're simply technical amendments to help us better track data and help with both the help with the charging and clarifying who is being charged with this particular crime.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 3018 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Next, Representative Gardner. The chair moves that House File 1217, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on the Civil Justice Committee. Members, Representative Gardner has an amendment that did not meet the 24-hour rule, but it's my understanding that all of the folks who are on this issue think that this is a more of a kumbaya moment if we adopt the amendment. So If there is no objection, I will waive the 24-hour rule for Representative Gardner. Does anyone object? All right. The amendment is...
So it would be the 1217A7, and we've discovered we need to make some minor grammatical oral amendments to that.
Okay. The chair moves the A7 amendment, and then Representative Gardner, why don't you share with us the oral amendments, and hopefully they won't be too difficult, and the staff will be able to get them, and we won't have to worry about that. So, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
On line 1.9, where it says line 12, cross out 12 and insert 9, so it's line 9, and then continuing on that line, where it says delete everything after A, after the word after and before the quotation marks, insert the second, because there's two A's in the line. And then finally on line 1.10, after the word law and before the quotation marks, insert or 2A.
Is that it, Representative Gardner?
That's it, Madam Chair.
Okay. Does staff have that amendment, or do we need to have it repeated? If you could repeat that one more time, Representative Gardner, for staff.
Certainly. On line 1.9, cross out the 12 and insert a 9. After the word after and before the first quotation marks, insert the two words the second. And on line 1.10, between the word law and the end quotation marks, the phrase or 2A, A being the letter A, 2 being the letters T-O.
Questions from members? Seeing none, the chair moves the A7 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the broad scope of the bill is to deal with the issue of prescription drug abuse as well as the creation of endocrine disruptors in our water caused in part by what happens to our unused drugs. I originally got into this bill because of the issues of endocrine disruptors where we have pharmaceuticals in our wastewater, which our drinking water plants don't really handle. It's affecting aquatic life and so on. Only one part of the whole problem is with waste pharmaceuticals, but as I started to look at it, it actually had a lot more to do with prescription drug abuse. And we've had several counties in Minnesota who have done community collections of prescription drugs and over-the-counter medication to get them out of the hands of people who have been concerned about people getting access to them. There have been increases in the percentage of prescription drug abuse, not just among teens, but among adults. One of the sources of those abused drugs happen to be from people's homes, and we're seeing people actually breaking into homes just for prescription drugs. At the same time, we've had good policy, which is the doctor shopping legislation, which is closing off an avenue for people to get access to drugs. And so it's my belief that people are going to start going into people's homes again. In the interest of time, I won't have Sergeant Schreck here from Chisago County talk about what they've done in their particular situation. But the amendment gets rid of Article 1 in the bill, which is a producer responsibility part of it. That's the controversial part that would ask drug producers to actually absorb the cost of secure collection and destruction. We went over that at great length in the Environment and Health Committee. But after talking with my Senate author and seeing that the bill wasn't moving in the Senate, we decided to proceed with a bill that was pared back and focused on the consensus items, which are in Article 2. And those parts deal specifically with this committee as it relates to controlled substances. The first part of Article 2 is what I call the no-flush provision. The standard practice to get rid of unused drugs in healthcare facilities has been to flush them down the toilet, and that's actually a major source of where some of these drugs in our wastewater is coming from. That's really done to get it out of the hands of people who should not have them. However, now that we understand the public health effects, it is a desired objective not to be flushing drugs down the toilet. After consulting with the nursing homes who felt that they were going to be stuck between state and federal laws that might conflict, we agreed on an amendment in the previous committee which says, okay, no flushing in healthcare facilities 6 months after the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency agrees to a blanket alternative disposal option. Right now, a healthcare facility could avoid flushing, but they must get permission from the DEA agent in charge, who happens to be in Minneapolis, on what that alternative disposal method might be. And in the interest of not creating a lot of bureaucracy with hundreds of nursing homes sending in letters to the agent in charge with plans and having to deal with that, we'd like to let the rulemaking process that the DEA has undertaken this year to run its course so we can figure out what's permissible for getting rid of the drugs without flushing them. So we came to consensus on that. The other parts have to do with who can possess a controlled substance for the purposes of destruction. And Mr. Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy was really instrumental in drafting that part to make sure that we still maintained control over our controlled substances and that we didn't increase the potential for diversion. I think it's very helpful, actually. State law currently says only a pharmacist may possess controlled substances other than the consumer, and federal law says that law enforcement may possess it as well for all the reasons you can think of. So this legislation makes it streamlined with federal law. It also allows hazardous waste transporters to possess controlled substances for the purposes of destruction. And I'm certainly familiar with that industry, and I know that they are very stringent about maintaining their manifests and so on to make sure that they take material for destruction. Right now we have a couple of collection programs going on where counties are collecting material and a transporter takes it or can take it to Illinois. That's actually the closest hazardous waste incinerator that we have to access. So technically, according to Minnesota law, you could pull over the driver of a truck who's carrying controlled substances for the purpose of destruction and write them up, because state law says they can't do it. That's the basic crux of what's in Article 2, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Questions from members.
My guess is you won't have a lot of testifiers now that we did the amendment. But
Representative Cornish.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Representative Gardner, what a couple of questions is, first of all, why is the civil penalty so high when you get one of these little boarding care homes or a fairly small operation? It seems like a large fine. The second one is there a standard for an appeal once you get assessed this? Is it covered under some other statute? Usually, like when the DNR or somebody does a civil penalty, they have a appeal process also in the statute.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish. That is actually a step that I'd like to take before we get to civil justice. It's actually taken a lot of homework as we go through each step from environment to healthcare to public safety to make sure the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. And that's the key question I have, is I'd like to sit down with staff and say, how does this compare with other penalties assessed on other similar things where people are just doing illegal disposal? And I'd like to seek your input for that as we, I believe, run civil justice, if I'm not mistaken.
Follow-up, Representative Cornish.
And then the other part, the appeal.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, that's a little bit out of my expertise as of this week, so I would definitely consult with staff before I bring an amendment forward in civil justice.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, I've got some concerns about the size of the civil penalty as well, but more specifically, I'm just curious. I don't know. What are the costs for, obviously, doesn't there's no marginal increased cost for a healthcare facility to flush a pharmaceutical down the toilet. What kind of costs will we be imposing on healthcare facilities to have pharmaceuticals disposed of? Line 10.4, you say, under the requirements of section 115A, 1410 to 1420, and I haven't had a chance to look at those, so I don't know what they entail and what they don't, but what kind of costs are we putting on our healthcare facilities?
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pulse, you know, in consultation with our nursing homes, that was a key concern, and they wanted to make sure that there was clear language from the federal government as to what other methods were allowed. I would say, as of today, if a, let's say the rules came out and said, if you have a hazardous waste transporter or vendor handle the stuff with a manifest, obviously there would be a cost to dispose. of that. I don't know what the rate is, but the nursing home has found this language acceptable. I will say that this bill and the research that has gone into it has made it very clear to me that we are spending a lot of money in the healthcare system, especially through taxpayer dollars on Medicaid, for example, and drugs that are paid for but never dispensed. Because somebody is a patient and they either die or they move home or they change the prescription or the concentration of the drug, and a residential facility like a nursing home is stuck with those drugs that somebody has paid for, and so they have to pay somebody to flush it down the toilet or they have to pay somewhere to truck it.
We're moving a little far afield of the jurisdiction of this committee.
I would just say there's lots of opportunity for cost savings for those facilities to help avoid waste in the first place, well, so they wouldn't incur the cost.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I'm not so sure that we are moving all that far afield because, you know, I don't know what these additional costs are, and I know that, you know, Ritchie Medical Center in Waconia isn't flush with cash. I know that Elam Nursing Home in Watertown, Minnesota doesn't have a lot of money sitting on the bottom line. And if it's going to be expensive for them to dispose of these by, you know, trucking them down to Illinois or whatever it's going to, whatever they're going to be required to do, they may be looking for ways to evade the law to avoid those costs. And that could create a whole bunch of additional problems. So I am concerned about the costs and the impacts on public safety, because if we set up a system that hospitals, clinics, nursing homes find overly expensive to comply with, we're putting them in a really tough position. And I don't want to provide any incentives, and I don't want to suggest that anybody's going to break the law. But we need to be cognizant of that because we do things around here all the time that have those kind of unintended consequences, and sometimes those things impact public safety. If Representative Gardner wants to make sure that we don't have controlled substances floating around and we're not letting people flush them any longer, I think that the cost, there is a relationship to public safety there, Madam Chair. So Representative Gardner, your bill's, I'm sure, going to get out of here today, move to the next committee and continue to move on. But I think you have to, I hope you'll come at least to the floor where I'll probably see this next and be prepared to discuss that because, I think it's a real issue. It's a public safety issue, and it's a broader issue. And I think members of this body have a right to ask those kinds of questions and get answers before we're asked to vote on them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner, you're saying on page 10.8, effective date is 6 months after the United States Drug Enforcement Administration approves an alternative system of disposable for unwanted drugs. Where did this language that you have in this bill here come from? Is it similar to a bill that's from the federal, or is it other states that have this language also, or we only just we're the first ones out of the chute here?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, actually Illinois currently prohibits all their healthcare facilities from flushing down the toilet. But the language you have here on the effective date was actually drafted in concert with Aging Services of Minnesota and care providers because they were looking for clear direction. The USDEA in January had something published in the Federal Register asking for comments for their rulemaking process to decide how to authorize alternative disposal options. That's actually the phrase that they use, so they don't get inundated with thousands of requests from individual facilities saying, we have a way that we'd like to avoid flushing and here's how we're going to do it, and they would just be under this pile of paperwork. So they want to go through a rulemaking process to say, all right, under these circumstances you can use the process X, Y, or Z, so that everyone would have clear direction on what's allowed and what's not allowed. So the language itself actually came with the help of the nursing homes, who would be some of the people affected. But the DEA is really serious about finding a way to dispose other than what's been proposed in the past.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gardner. So the language in part also came from the state of Illinois. Are they recommending the same kind of penalty that is here in this bill? And are there other states now contemplating this also?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, there's actually a lot of states that are considering something to this degree. And again, I would just say I'm not a specialist on where an appropriate level is for the civil penalty, so I'm very interested in talking to staff and committee members and civil justice to see what the what that right level is.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I think the penalty of $10,000 is quite extreme, and I would really urge Representative Gardner to look at that issue, as other members have mentioned here. So, thank you.
Representative Schimanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gardner, sorry I couldn't be here for the beginning of your testimony on this bill, but two questions I have. You talked about possibly transporting these pharmaceuticals to Illinois for incineration. Do you know what type of process they go through to dispose of these in Illinois?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schimanski, rotating kiln incineration technology is what they use. And there is some discussion about whether we could use municipal solid waste incinerators here in Minnesota. And so the Pollution Control Agency is looking at that option. That would be actually cheaper and more preferable.
Representative Schimanski.
Is the focus of this bill more so the environmental aspect of keeping the pharmaceuticals out of the waste stream? Or is it more for the legal aspect of keeping them out of other people's hands, you know, illicit users, if you will?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schimanski, the no flesh provision in Article 2 is about public health and environment. The rest of it, as it relates to transportation, is really about keeping it out of people's hands.
One more Representative question. Schimanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question, then, is just scanning this bill quickly, it deals mostly with health care providers, you know, pharmacies and so forth. Anything in relation to law enforcement where they may be confiscating some of these same drugs from, you know, illicit activity?
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Schimanski, the issue of possessing for the purposes of evidence is something that I'm not that familiar with. I'm sure we could get you an answer to that. I don't know if that's something you want to address here, but
well, let's just see if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill. Seeing none, Representative Coles.
All right, Madam Chair, now I'm thoroughly confused and I apologize, but I think we need another amendment. We got rid of, with the A7 amendment, we got rid of Section 1 of the bill. And Section 1 of the bill is, or Article 1, excuse me, of the bill is referred to on page 10, line 4, and provides the mechanism, the method by which healthcare facilities are supposed to dispose of these. And so I'm not sure, Madam Chair, what kind of direction we're giving nursing homes and hospitals and clinics and other places. Maybe I'm wrong, Representative Gardner. I'm not trying to. We got to tell them what they're supposed to do, and I think we just took out what they're supposed to do.
Madam Chair,
I'm not sure what we're doing here.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Paul, you talk about line 10.4.
Yes, I am.
Which says with the requirements of Section 115A.141, blah blah blah.
And that's Article 1 that we just deleted.
Right.
That's new statutory language.
One at a time.
Sorry,
through the chair. Representative Cole.
That's, Madam Chair, that's new statutory language. That's why I pulled out the book. I was trying to find it, and then I realized that was Article 1. So,
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, you're correct, and Mr. Eloff has suggested language to replace that phrase of the sections and just replace it with a quick phrase that we could do here, if that works.
Representative Gardner, why don't you tell us what it is?
Sure.
And then, these are amendments that did not make the 24-hour rule, so we have to make sure that the members don't have
it. Very good, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Gardner.
On line 10.4, this would be deleting the phrase of sections 115A.1410 to 115A.1410 to 115A.1420. Cross out that phrase. And insert the phrase applicable state and federal laws. And I can repeat that, Madam Chair, if you want.
Please repeat it, Representative Gardner.
On line 10.4, delete the phrase of sections 115A.1410 to 115A.1420 and replace it with the phrase applicable state and federal laws.
Representative Coles.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe that helps us get it out of here, but now we're telling them to comply with state law. I don't know that we need to, well, I'll Representative Gardner, this needs some more work still. You're not done yet, I don't think. If that's the change, I mean, we can't leave it as it is because we got rid of Article 1. So, to get it out of here. But we're basically saying, okay, healthcare facilities follow the law. That's what that new language would do. Dispose of it as you're told to dispose of it by state and federal law. Well, yeah.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct. In some of the previous committees, we wanted to give some comfort language to facilities to show that they were not going to be asked to do something by the state that wasn't applicable with state or federal law in other areas. I don't know if that makes any sense, but.
Representative Gardner, this is really part of the health care portion of the bill, other than the fact that it is then the civil penalty, which will go to Representative Mullery's committee, which is right below it. So, Representative Mullery, will you make certain that between here and there that you and Representative Gardner work on that issue and address the civil penalty language, given that it's within the jurisdiction of your committee?
Wonderful.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to what we're looking at also on page 11, it references on 11.9, sections 115A.1413. And that would be the part of Article 1 that we just took out. So that should be changed, too.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I believe the 8th Amendment actually did fix that.
The 7th Amendment?
Right. Oh, I'm sorry, the 7th Amendment.
Any other questions for members? Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, I guess the question I have is, are we going to act on, are we going to, I haven't moved an amendment to 10-4 yet. I know we had some suggested language from Representative Gardner. I'm curious, Madam Chair, as to what your intention is.
Representative Coles, we have a 24-hour rule, and I don't allow amendments if any member of the committee objects to it. So if you're not going to object to making that change, then we can let him change it here. Otherwise, if anyone is going to object to making that change, then he won't be allowed to change it here. It is not within the jurisdiction of this committee for that section. It is within the jurisdiction of Representative Mullery's committee. And Representative Mullery has made it very clear that he will work with Representative Gardner. So it's up to this committee on what they would like to do. So Representative Coles, do you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair, I have great faith and confidence in my good friend Representative Mullery to get this all cleared up in his committee. So I'm sure it will come out of there crystal clear, and I look forward to hopefully being able to support it on the floor. We'll see, though.
Sounds wonderful. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, in return for that commitment, I hope that Representative Coles will work with the staff and everybody else for the Civil Justice Committee to clear it up.
All right. Given the fact that this is really within the Civil Justice Committee's jurisdiction, I kind of let us go a little far afield anyways, typically, than I would let us go here in the committee. Are there any other concerns from members on the committee? All right. Representative Gardner, I will renew my motion that House File 1217, second engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative Lesh?
Yes.
Can we do the reports from the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division? Representative Lesh, welcome back. Typically, your committee gives a report to our committee about the bills that you've heard and what your committee has done, and then we don't repeat all the testimony that that was taken in your committee, but we act on the things that we need to. We take whatever testimony we need to, and then we move on.
Indeed.
Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh moves the adoption of the division report on House File 2864 and House File 2608.
Indeed. Madam Chair, we did, in fact, act on each one of these bills, House File 2864 and 2608. The House File 2864 was passed with an additional oral amendment by Representative Gardner, which was acceptable to the committee, and there was not a lot of discussion on that. We did hear from testimony by individuals that worked with victims of domestic abuse. It was very supportive. I believe Representative Shemansky had a question, but I believe that was addressed. And as far as House File 2608, that was yours, Madam Chair, and that had a testifier from, well, there was also, everyone was supportive of that as well, Madam Chair. There was, and if you wanted to be heard on that and speak to it, because it was your bill.
All right. Representative Gardner, do you have anyone in, or do you need, have any issue that you need to have addressed before this, that has anything changed since Representative Lesch's committee? I just, because I'm going to ask for public testimony, and I want to make certain that you don't have any comments you need to make. Representative Gardner?
Madam Chair, that's what took place in Representative Lesch's committee. Representative Paymar did have some questions about the flow and relating around data privacy and so on, so some of the advocates have worked to come up with something to fix that. Again, that's also a 24-hour rule violation, and I think staff has probably talked to some of the advocates to see that we move it along, but it's not a, I wouldn't call it a substantive change.
Okay, so that is the DE1 amendment. So we're going to first move the adoption of the crime victims report, and then we'll take up each of the bills. So Representative Lesch moves adoption of the division report on House File 2864 and 2608. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. All right, Representative Gardner, I will move that House File 2864 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance, and then you have the DE1 amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, again, this did not meet the 24-hour rule. Is there any objection to dealing with this amendment? It's my understanding it's mostly technical changes. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. I have some advocates here to answer any questions should they arise about the DE1.
All right. Any objections from members about this amendment? Seeing none, the chair moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 2864 as amended? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 2864 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Members, next is House File 2608. This is my bills, and I would move that House File 2608 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. There are questions from members. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, as I think you know, I was unable to attend Representative Lesch's committee hearing, and I actually heard, I don't know if the individual who contacted me was a constituent or not, but I heard from an individual about this bill who expressed some concerns that it, you know, we're dealing with ex parte orders, so we're dealing with one party going in to seek an order for protection, and I'm generally supportive of what we're trying to do here, but the situation that this individual raised is apparently a real situation. I haven't spoken with this individual, but the language, including a reasonable area surrounding the dwelling or residence, I understand what's intended to happen, but according to this individual, his parents literally lived next door to him, and had his wife, they were not divorced yet, but apparently there was some acrimony, and she sought an ex parte order, and had she gone in, he could have been prevented without any opportunity and without any knowledge that this order was being sought ex parte from being present in his parents' home, because the way the breadth of this language raised some concern for me. I don't have an amendment today. Obviously, I wouldn't have met the 24-hour rule, but I agree with sort of the direction we're headed here. I understand, but I think there might be a need to work on the language a little bit, at least some interest that I would have in making sure that we are, you know, if somebody's going to go in and get an order that extends beyond the residence, maybe, and I'm thinking out loud, maybe they should have to attest to the fact that, you know, they're not keeping somebody from an immediate family member next door or something like that. I don't know what the right answer is. I'm, like I said, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, Madam Chair. I just want to flag the issue as it moves forward. I'll be in contact with you, Madam Chair, as this moves to the floor. And I look forward to talking to the advocates about this as well. Again, I understand generally the policy. I'm generally supportive, but when we have, whenever we have ex parte orders, when we have one party going in and there's not an opportunity for the other party to be heard on that, yes, it's temporary. Yes, it's short term, but we still need to make sure that everybody's interests and rights are protected to the extent we can.
Madam Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cole, when this idea was first broached to me, I had similar concerns, and then I read it. I know that in court, an OFP is a civil order, so what happens is the judge or the referee has to designate in the order where exactly you are prohibited from being. So in this case, where you had your constituent that contacted you, they have to state that this is actually what's going on. Now, it's an ex parte order, so it's the victim coming in straight away, but typically questions are asked also by the judge or referee of the individual seeking the order, and it's a short-term order. That's also taken into consideration when, in fact, a charging decision is made if there is any violation of that OFP. So because it's short-term, as has been stated, and because of those additional considerations that the judge actually has to specify the location they're prohibited from, it's not just a blanket reasonable area, that's what satisfied my concerns.
And Representative Cole, I'm happy to continue to chat with you. Just so you know, we made this consistent with folks, with what folks can already get in the next step order. So this isn't brand new. It is based on the other law. But I'm happy to continue to talk with you and work with you on the issue. Representative Cole.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And I understand what you're saying. The difference, of course, is that when the permanent order is put in place, you know, both parties are there, both parties are present. The alleged or the person against whom the order is sought has an opportunity to say, hey, my mother, who is 82 years old and I am the primary caregiver for, happens to live literally 30 feet from my residence or my wife's residence or my spouse's residence or whatever the case may be, you know, that could be prevented under this scenario, and I need to think about the issue a little more. I appreciate your willingness to talk about it some more. I think there's a way to work out that issue, and I think we can likely find it together, but I wanted to flag the issue.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, given the fact, again, these are ex parte orders, and I understand that a very, very, very high percentage of these are almost automatically granted by judges in Minnesota counties. I guess I have questions or maybe concerns about the ex parte process generally in Minnesota statutes. I'd actually like us to review that at some time. I know this isn't the time. I'm curious as to what level of testimony there was in Representative Lesh's committee. I would really like to hear more testimony on it somehow.
Well, and Representative Driskowski, I do have everyone that testified in Representative Lesh's committee here to answer any questions, and we can certainly have them come to the table to do that. I don't want to do a full repeat. We try not to, but then I'll also be asking if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill as well. Is that Representative Driskowski?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is there anybody that testified that was falsely accused and eventually an order was provided or applied to them in a falsely accused situation? Was there anybody that testified?
No one testified in opposition to the bill during the hearing.
Oh, really?
Okay. Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Cornish.
just in support of the actual proposal, I'd rather err on this side than the other side, and too often, if you don't get the area big enough, the time that goes between the orders, the person gets by with all sorts of harassment and peering and peeping and whatever else he or she can do outside the curtilage of the. So I guess I like the proposal the way it is.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this kind of goes back to a question that I asked in our Crime Victims Committee in terms of the order for protection and the spouse who was ordered to, you know, stay clear, how much access they had to recover property from the residents and so forth. And to just build on that a little bit, the question would be if the person under order for protection, if they had a home-based business and, you know, would not be able to, you know, maintain the business or, you know, remove the property essential to operating that business in the time allotted, you know, would there be some provisions that, you know, they would, you know, have access to maintain their line of business under this order of protection?
Representative Szymanski, the answer that was given during committee is that when there is an ex parte order, that with a police escort, the party is able to go back to the home one time to collect whatever belongings they need to collect. And then, of course, after the next hearing, when it isn't an ex parte order, then the order would be modified as needed to be. But at this point, after an ex parte order, it is only one time, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Hey, my name is Bill Ronan. I'm from Hopkins. I want to give you a little bit of information about myself so you know who I am. I'm a licensed, independent, clinical social worker. I'm a Minnesota Crime Victims Mental Health Professional. I authored an article called Treating the Battering Husband in a peer-reviewed journal. I'm a Minnesota divorce mediator. I did Family Crisis Intervention Unit, the first one in the country in Erie, Pennsylvania. I was a volunteer at the Erie County Rape Crisis Center. I'm also a widowed father, single father, without any family in the area, raising my only son for the last 15 years. He's now 19. I'm also a member of the Lions Club. What I want to talk about is false accusations. There are 0% prosecutions of false accusations and perjury, and this comes from the Minnesota State Court Administrator. To me, right there, that tells us we don't have justice in our state. When you have 0% prosecution, that means that that one crime doesn't happen. This is ridiculous. I married a woman from overseas, being a widowed father. For her to get citizenship, the fast ticket to citizenship was to accuse me of domestic violence when there was absolutely nothing of that sort that ever happened. She went to the local domestic violence shelter in Hopkins called Sojourner. They assisted her in false accusations, which would have put me in jail for 3 months. I already spent a night in jail without any possible hearing, not even knowing why I was being arrested. The police stopped by and said, "Did you touch her?" Well, if you have to, any one of you here, did you touch me today? You might say, "Well, I don't know. Could have." That's the evidence the police used to arrest me. The domestic violence shelter conjured up their own false accusations, labeled them against me. But the arresting officer, what would have been the arresting officer from the Minnetonka Police Force, he saw what was happening. He saw the information that I was gathering. He refused to arrest me. Later, when I had time, I wanted to bring charges against Sojourner and the domestic violence organization. But he said to me, "No, you can't do that. They have too much money. They will go through judge after judge until they get one that does they're bidding, and you will lose. In court, a judge ordered me not to report the federal felony of immigration fraud. I was ordered, in order to get my divorce, not to report the federal felony of immigration fraud. In the first trial, the judge would not allow a single witness to testify. 30 were character witnesses. The other 10 had known my wife, who was bragging to them about what she was doing. And the judge, and I have their names, and I'll gladly give them to you, would not allow a single witness to testify.
Are you, if I could just, are you talking about during the domestic abuse hearing, or are you talking about the divorce hearing?
I'm talking about the whole thing is connected, because this is what gets their citizenship and the false accusations.
Okay, well, I'm
when people are pretending to be victims, and then they victimize others.
I'm going to just ask you that you keep it to the ex parte order and the granting of the order for protection, because
comment
on your divorce.
My business was in my home. I'm a therapist. I was treating victims of abuse, actual victims of abuse. I was treating people who were also being abusers. And had that order stuck, I wouldn't have been able to continue doing that. And it would be virtually impossible for me to move my office and do that. What I'm saying, this whole thing is terrible. This is in India, where they do this. They arrest the entire family, and they're following our laws here. They're taking our Violence Against Women Act, and because the families are so close, they arrest the entire family. They're calling it legal terrorism. The courts there are calling it legal terrorism, because the wife can say to her husband, if you don't do as I say, basically extortion, I'll have you and your family arrested. Here is just the man.
You get about one more minute.
And I just returned from D.C. with meetings with members of Congress, their legislative staff, to go over this. We're hoping it's done. I'll complete with, in Germany, they came first for the communist. And I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the trade unionist. And I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. And I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me. And by that time, there was no one left to speak up. Please change these laws. Don't let this injustice continue. I is the only one that I know of that was considered, everything was not guilty or the charges were dropped. The people at the courthouse were utterly amazed because nobody gets a chance to defend themselves in this situation.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
thank you, and I thank the gentleman for his testimony. Also, just by way of correction, he cited stats from the State Court Administrator's Office. I know I have personally charged two individuals in the last 3 years with 609-505 falsely reporting a crime on this, so with respect to that, it has happened, and the stats are probably incorrect. So this does happen, in fact, members of the committee, when there is a crime against the administration of justice like this.
Okay. I'll clear that up. It's 0.00164%. There are some.
Thank you. All right. There was someone else in the audience. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I have two handouts.
Could please state your name for the record. Yeah,
John Kiselishin.
Okay. The page, want to bring me copy? Bring me the handouts. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, my name is John Kiselishin. I have been a full-time stay-at-home dad for the past 7 years. I run two businesses out of my home. I also happen to be one of probably only a handful of men in the state of Minnesota who solely holds a state daycare license, and I am a licensed daycare provider. Prior to being the primary caregiver for my children, I served as mayor in the city of Roseville from 2000 to 2004. Now, I'm here today, and I brought along a picture of myself and my two children, because I want to put a face to this. I'm here today because my son and I are both victims of domestic abuse, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 2608 because my children and I are also victims of the ex parte order process. Had House File 2608 been law back in November of 2008, my parents, who have health issues and live next door to me, would also have been victims of the ex parte order process, along with other members of my family. Now, in November 2008, in the middle of a divorce process, an incident occurred in our home, and I promptly called the police. They arrived, and the police noted that my son was afraid of my wife and clung to me tightly and would not let her touch him. They also noted that my wife stated to them that she intentionally struck me in the back while I was holding our son. Based upon the preponderance of evidence, the police, though, determined that her actions did not rise to the level of domestic assault. Therefore, they would not remove her from the home. 4 days later, after consulting with her divorce attorney, my wife created a brand new story of what happened that evening, along with several other broad, generalized accusations, and was immediately granted an ex parte order removing me from our home and preventing me from having contact with my children. Now, had House File 2608 been the law at the time, I'm 100% positive that not only would I have been prevented from, removed from my home, but I also would have been prevented from going to my parents' home next door. Probably also my brother's home, which is in Roseville, and several of my relatives' homes who all live in Roseville. The day after the ex parte order was granted, Marine, the police department domestic violence investigator, issued a police report stating that no assault occurred and that my wife's news story lacked credibility. But unfortunately, the opinion of local law enforcement is meaningless because there is no authority under statute for the police department to have any participation in the ex parte order process. Now, I encourage people to look at my handouts because based upon my personal experiences, I've detailed what information is needed to get an order versus a permanent order, ex parte versus permanent. On the back side, I've listed what information was given in my case along with the facts that were omitted. Now, I think supporters of this legislation do bring forward some good points, but there's a lack of due process and a lack of any mandated involvement of law enforcement has to be recognized. Expanding an ex parte order authority to mirror the permanent order authority should only be done if the protections that exist under the permanent order process are also extended to the ex parte order process. And as a victim of domestic abuse and a victim of this ex parte order process, I'm opposed to this bill and to any expansion of the ex parte order process unless we can somehow bring local law enforcement in as having a mandated role under statute. And Madam Chair, if I could respond to two of the questions that were asked here this evening or this afternoon of the members. There was a question raised about a person being allowed to take stuff out of their home. The Roseville police indicated to me that they have about 15 minutes worth of time to allow somebody to remove stuff from their home. They're busy. They have a lot of calls that they're going on. It would have probably taken me 6 hours and a moving truck in order to move my business out of the home. There's no officer, I don't think, anywhere in the state that's going to grant that kind of time. It's just not going to happen. The second question was raised about whether there are questions that are asked when you get these orders, questions if there are relatives that nearby, so on and so forth. I went through the ex parte order process. I went down to the domestic violence office, and I filed for an order for protection against my wife. So I've been through the process, and I can tell you that in Ramsey County, those questions are not asked. They may be asked in other counties, but from my personal experience, those questions are not asked in Ramsey County. That's all I have. I to go to my handouts. The second handout that I had was the article on the David Letterman fighting the restraining order. I admit, this is certainly an extreme case, but, I mean, it is an example of what can happen when, my guess is that in New Mexico, like in Minnesota, local law enforcement doesn't have any mandated statutory authority to participate in this process. And if they probably did in New Mexico, my guess is the outcome could have been different. Thank you.
Representative
for questions.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, most of the comments you've heard here, I think, are really kind of outside of the realm of what we're looking at here today. You're looking at curtilage or the area around, not how the order is gotten, whether there's lies or conspiracy. One claims there's a conspiracy where the cops helped. One says where the cops hurt. We can't cure all those evils. And as unnerving as it is to go through this, it's also unnerving for the victim to come out and find cigarette butts that have been left there all night while the spouse watches their house, or footprints in the snow. And that's what we're trying to, we can't solve all of your problems of abuse. And it's probably some that happened. But the reason ex parte is and orders were gotten in the first place is you don't always have time for due process. Due process is another word for the victim dying. And so that's why this, I think, was expanded to the way it is. So I still support the bill and think it's a good effort here.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that the testifier mentioned to me that's a little troubling is that it sounded like the court wouldn't accept what you had told the officers that came to your house as far as part of testimony, or that they wouldn't allow it in the court. And I'm just wondering, how did that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's no requirement for that information to be brought forward. The person who's going down there and filing for the order, it is solely upon them to decide whether they want to bring forward that information or not. If the law required that the court must contact the local law enforcement authorities, this issue would have come up. It would have been brought forward. The judge would have been made aware that there was currently an investigation being done by the domestic violence investigator. But since there's no requirement in law on either part, that's why it's not brought forward. And Madam Chair, in response to Representative Cornish's comments, I agree there are these are serious issues. What I'm asking for is maybe as a compromise that somehow we work into this process that local law enforcement have some sort of a role, because currently they don't, unless it's voluntarily brought forward.
Thank you. Just 1 second, Representative Lesh. I believe there was there someone else in the audience that wanted to testify as well? Because we only have 4 minutes left of committee, and I want to make sure that we, okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kisilishin, I'm intrigued by your proposal to have law enforcement step in. And of course, as we know in these situations, law enforcement does find itself in the middle of disputes and tries to negotiate those as carefully as they can. That said, as a prosecutor, I am apprehensive about putting law enforcement in a position of having to render an opinion on who's right and who's wrong at that point, because it goes back to the old dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. I just want the facts in the report, and it's up to the court system, the judicial system, to determine who's right and who's wrong. And by forcing law enforcement into that position, I think it would cloud up the process. If you can come up with a way to do it that would streamline the process and thereby secure better justice for everyone involved, I'm ready to listen.
Representative Hillstrom.
Can you pronounce your name again?
Kisilishin.
Kisilishin.
And Representative Lesh, I would simply think that a positive step forward would be requiring a phone call, not necessarily a rendering of a decision of person A is right and person B is wrong, but just simply there being communication would have been very positive, I think, in my situation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kisilishin, thank you for your testimony. Could you share with us, and maybe you did, what degree of contemplation was there in the process for the filing of the restraining order? I mean, I don't know how many members are familiar with this part of law, but within this process, there's really no contemplation whatsoever. Basically, the judge, as I understand it, gets the request, and 99.9997% of the time grants it without even considering the circumstances. Can you tell us more?
Well, actually, we've got 1 minute and 45 seconds till we have to get out of this room. So if you can make your comments in 45 seconds,
yes.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative, the statute requires very little information to be brought forward. Anything beyond what is in the statute, which is very little, is strictly voluntary. And that's, I think, you know, a key point to bring up. If
Thank
the statute required more information, maybe better decisions would be made. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I renew my motion that House File 2608 be recommended and placed on the general register. Oh, it was amended in division, so it would be as amended by the division. No, it was not. So, sorry about that. Bad advice from my staff here. So I renew my motion that House File 2608 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. I need a motion for the minutes. Representative Mason, moves the minutes of February 23rd. Any changes or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Lesh moves the minutes of February 18th. Any changes or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. This meeting is adjourned.